when you tell them, you know, you just get home.
Okay, we'll do our pals together. So when you do the bows, think of the Buddha in the space before you. Think of paying respects to an enlightened being. Generate a sense of real openness and receptivity to the teachings. And that you bow with your body, speech, and mind, really thinking of the opportunity to dedicate a little while towards your spiritual practice and really increasing your understanding of the Dharma. Okay, so then with a good motivation, we'll do the bows. So we'll start with the prayers. Again, and as we say the prayers, also think of the Buddha or His Holiness the Dalai Lama in the space before you, and that as you say the prayers, Buddhas and other enlightened beings really hear your request and your prayers, really think of your motivation and understanding of the Dharma as we say this. Okay. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, again, Lama Tsongkhapa is the founder of the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism. He lived in the 14th century, and he was a Tibetan, and started Ganden Monastery, which has a photo up the left and right. The left and center photos are Ganden Monastery, which began in his time. He was an eminent scholar, practitioner, author, and he really was the great elucidator of the Buddha's teachings from many of the different Buddhist faiths and traditions, whether it's Chinese or Japanese, Korean, all the Mahayana teachings that started in the first century with really the profound teachings of Nagarjuna, who went further in this understanding of emptiness and the potential of the enlightened mind, started with Nagarjuna. And Lama Tsongkhapa was able to clarify a lot of the teachings for the Tibetan practitioners. So he's greatly revered by all traditions. So we'll say the Guru Yoga. From the heart of the Lord of the Gandan Devas emerges a brilliant white cloud, like a great mass of fresh yogurt, atop Sitsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dharma. We request your coming to this place along with your great disciples. My Lord Guru is seated before me on a lion throne, lotus, and moon cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons and serve as the supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teachings. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wondrous admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, whom merely viewing, hearing, or contemplating earns one great merit. I present to you, supreme field of merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more, both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind I have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my three vows, Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana. I regret extremely from the depths of my heart and reveal each and every such action. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the eight worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. Pray, all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitate a rain of vast and profound Dharma from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of the rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on unchanging, without waning, until samsara ends. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dharma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring master Tsongkhapa shine forever. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara. Untainted by ego's delusion, your Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom, you are a Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Losang Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Losang Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Losang Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Glorious, precious Rukhu, please take the lotus seat at my crown, and in your kindness, please give us. Bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious, precious Rukhu, please take this lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessing for temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat of our hearts and in your great kindness remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the unattainment element. Can we go back to those last three verses and just take a moment for our practice? Okay, so that we're not just racing through the words. Okay, so the first one is, glorious precious root Guru, take the lotus seat at my crown and in your kindness please care for us. So imagine inviting enlightened being Buddha or His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Tsongkhapa, to just in your pure imagination and your virtuous mind. So a very tiny image of Lama Tsongkhapa or the Buddha to come and sit on the lotus seat and a moon disc on the crown of your head. So very, very tiny, made of light and made of your virtuous mind. And then the second verse, glorious precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts and in your great kindness care for us. Grant us your blessing for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. So you imagine the image dissolves into light, descends through your crown, and just floods your body, speech, and mind with this virtuous light, washing away all difficulties and sickness, all negativities and misunderstandings, particularly our misunderstanding of the nature of phenomena and the nature of reality. Imagine the Buddha then descends to the lotus seat at your heart and becomes non-different than your enlightened potential. And then with the third verse, glorious precious root Guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts and in your great kindness remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So imagine that the Buddha becomes totally merged. That your wish for spiritual enlightenment remains with you until you achieve enlightenment. So we'll continue. Unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. So take a few moments to consider the nature of our interdependence, our interrelatedness with all phenomena, how our actions have profound effects, and that through purifying our delusions and our negative actions, and accumulating the virtuous qualities of enlightened beings, that our own mental continuum becomes more and more clear and able to benefit others and ourselves with compassion and wisdom. And then think about how there is no independent, permanent self-existence of self or any phenomena. And we'll recite the mandala offering. Imagine filling the skies with offerings that you enjoy, objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental objects that please all beings everywhere. So things that are free and miraculous, like fragrant flowers and beautiful places. Places where people can really study and understand the Dharma and all virtuous activities. So imagine filling the skies with this and offering it to holy masters and all beings everywhere. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, visualize before me this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniyataya Me. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly, from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So, Venerable Sultan Geshe Sultan Gyaltsen is still in Boston. He's not here yet, and it was on the schedule that he would be here, so I apologize if you made the long journey here to listen to Geshe-la today. His schedule changed after we went to press, so he'll be back on Tuesday, and I believe he'll be teaching on Wednesday night. So please come back to, Geshe-la will be continuing to teach on Wednesday. Okay, so I wanted to continue from where we left off a little bit. We did the six causes and one effect. Sometimes they talk about seven causes and one effect, because they oftentimes don't include the aspect of equanimity and how we need to really establish a sense of equanimity in cultivating our respect and openness to all sentient beings, not just to the ones that we love, not just to people that we seek favor with, but all sentient beings. So we're really looking at how do we cultivate this mental attitude that generates a sense of equanimity for all beings. Okay, so so today I wanted to move on from there, but let's recap all those points. So we start with equanimity, and then what were the other points we went over last week? All beings are our mothers. Okay, a challenging first point. And then? Mm-hmm. Remembering the kindness of all our mothers. Then? Repaying the kindness. Next? Cultivating love. Yeah, wishing them happiness. Cultivating compassion, which is? Wishing them to be free from suffering, okay? Good. And then? Altruistic intention, yes, altruistic intention. Exceptional thought with the wish that all beings can attain enlightenment and that you're the one, okay? You're the one that's going to bring it about. And then the result? Result bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word meaning? Enlightened mind, mind of enlightenment. Yeah, very good. Yeah, what we're trying to do is cultivate the causes so that we have an enlightened mind ourselves. And so some of these practices are really about cultivating the conditions so that we can really experience and attain this mind of enlightenment. So that's one of the practices, and it really follows along with this next section that we go into, which is Dagshen Nyampa. Dagshen Nyampa. Dag is self, Shen is others, Nyampa is equalizing self and others. So. So again, this is something that Geshe-la taught, and I'm just allowing us the time to contemplate it, discuss it, and work with it so that we can pound out any misunderstandings as well as we can, and to really establish a greater understanding of it. So this particular section, practicing the practice of equalizing self and others, has fewer points in it, but they say it generally comes after this practice that we did last week of all beings being our mothers and cultivating bodhicitta from there, because it comes to us from the lineage of Nagarjuna, who I mentioned earlier, first century saint. Who really brought back the teachings from the Nagas of the Heart Sutra and the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, that they were, even though the Buddha lived in the 6th century BC, right? Nagarjuna lived in the 1st century, so they say oftentimes that these particular teachings were also from the Buddha, but that they were hidden and cared for by the Nagas in another realm because we weren't quite ready for them yet. And so they were waiting for us to evolve in our practice so that we could really go to this next level of understanding emptiness and dependent arising and the Buddha's teachings. So this lineage came from Nagarjuna and his spiritual sons, and it's very clearly stated in Shantideva. Shantideva, who wrote, again, The Way of the Bodhisattva, or Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, an incredible teaching done in verse for anyone who's interested. It's a marvelous teaching of how to practice. So one of the verses is this, and we'll start with that. Would someone with a nice booming voice please volunteer to read it? Okay, go ahead.
Whatever suffering there is in the world arises. arises from desire for one's own personal happiness. Whatever happiness there is derives from desiring happiness for others.
Okay. Okay, well, that's the teaching. Does anyone want to share what they get initially from that? Mingla?
Well, whatever you think, oh, I want you to be happy and then become very selfish and do something. And then the result, the effect of it is suffering, because now we're causing somebody else to suffer because we really don't care about somebody else at all. And then they will, in turn, do the same thing towards us. It reverses us instead of thinking that I'm going to be really happy and causing someone else to be unhappy. They're going to do the same thing back to us. So then we have suffering instead of happiness.
Okay, does someone want to explain what you feel from the second two lines? Pam?
Well, the first is kind of like self-grasping, and I'm thinking of myself, what I want, so it doesn't feel good. It just doesn't feel good. But
I always want things for myself.
Yeah, but...
Why does it feel lighter?
Mm-hmm. In a way, it's part of the responsibility of taking happiness for yourself off of your shoulders if you just focus on serving others, cherishing others. The happiness comes that way rather than trying to seek it, trying to manifestly pursue something.
Uh-huh. It takes the burden off your own shoulders. Uh-huh. Nice. Okay. Uh-huh.
Desire brings disappointment, but there's nothing disappointing in giving to others.
Mm-hmm. But people can be so disappointing. Not to what?
Not to be unconditionally.
Okay, good. So whatever suffering there is in the world arises from desire from one's own personal happiness. Whatever happiness there is in the world derives from desiring happiness for others. And he continues by saying, what need is there to say more? The childish work for themselves, the able ones work for the sake of others, and look at the difference. If one doesn't attempt to truly exchange one's own happiness for the suffering of others, one will fail to become a Buddha, and even in samsara will be bereft of happiness. So again, you know, it's like looking at this higher view of wishing to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, of becoming a Buddha for the benefit of others, and it's telling you how to go about doing this. Know that if we begin to take, as you're saying, to take the load off our own shoulders, where we're only thinking and focusing on ourselves, we can begin to other direct and really clear away the sense of self-centeredness. So this talk to is a very self-centered view, and it's saying you see what faults there are in it. And the second one is the other cherishing view, which is showing the advantages. Yeah. Advantages are saying, well, whatever happiness that you're going to see, you know, this is really the advantage of coming from desiring happiness for others. Okay? So, what is self-centeredness? Let's look at that. Let's kind of focus a little more at what's self-centeredness. Dana.
Well, if you think of a circle and a point in the middle of the circle, your self is radiating out from that.
Uh-huh.
Your view, your perception. And so you're trying to pull everything in that you want towards that point in the middle of the circle.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that? Mm-hmm. Glenn.
The first priority is yourself.
First priority is yourself, okay.
And
the second, third, and fourth as well. Okay.
Surely. It's the same thing that we're all saying, that this is me and this is the world.
Uh-huh.
It's all about me.
Right, right. Yeah, Robert Thurman says that's why we call it the universe. It's all about me, right? And then versus the Buddha verse, which is all beings are potential teachers for all of us. Teachers and potential enlightened beings. You know, when we say all beings can attain enlightenment, we're looking at this thought, you know? And when we have this self-centered view, it's all about, well, what's in it for me and how can you benefit me? Yeah. So, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. And they call it a mind of attachment that clings to I and mine. A mind of attachment that clings to I and mind. And the object is overindulgence. On me, it's all about me. Yeah? It grasps at the I as existent from its own side, craving that holds the self dearly, the view of the transitory collection as innate. What's the transitory collection? The aggregates, yeah, the aggregate, five skandhas, exactly, five skandhas. Five skandhas, the heaps, the aggregates are heaps, right? The heaps, like if you go to a place where they sell gravel and rock, you know, it's like a little fine and then gets a little more bulky and bulkier. The aggregates, aggregation, the aggregate, and what are those five aggregates? Body, Glenn. Mm-hmm. Yeah, feeling. Uh huh. Well, that comes up in a feeling. Yeah. Perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Okay, when we try to define what this is. What the me is, it's these five aggregates, these heaps of these five aggregations of things. That's what we call the self. And when you penetrate any of them or all of them, you lose, you know, the more you focus on trying to find where is that self, that one that's so important, you lose it. No, it's like applying the heat of attention to the form. Where is the self in the form? You lose it. It disappears. Yeah? And then you look at the aggregate of your feeling, which is generally attachment, aversion, and ignorance, delusion. You know, you look in all of those and you lose it as well. Where is there any permanent, independent self in that? Yeah, your perception, how you perceive and comprehend things. Where is there any self in that? Yeah, and then all the mental views that come out of it, and in your consciousness itself. So you keep analyzing and looking, where is that self? So view of the transitory collection is innate, and then it's also pride directed at the I. Okay, so an understanding of this self, yeah, what is the self-centeredness? It's pride directed at the I. So your example is very good, right? Here you are in the middle with everything else circulating around me. Yeah. And there's so many limitations in that, you know, when everything is to be focused on number one, no, it's really hard to get everybody to cooperate, especially if everybody else is having that same view. Yeah, and then it's really hard as well, because it's hard to keep, you know, it just gets really irritating having things not work out towards the way I want it. Okay, so so it, and then on top of that, it just creates more irritation and suffering. And then look at the way we act when we're irritated. You know, when you're not doing things the way I want you to do them, you're not acting the way I want you to act, and so, you know, you're not pleasing me, and therefore I'm irritated. It's like you just perpetuate your own suffering. You create your own misery, you know, in this view. It's really quite obnoxious. Okay, so so this self-centeredness is the culprit that we're trying to look at. So and this equalizing self and others, you know, it's like, observe how we're all so uniquely different. Yeah, even among identical twins, you can say, oh, there's so many similarities where they look alike and they have many actions that are similar. But still, you know, there are differences. There are subtle differences in the way they act and live and what they do. So, you know, observe how in your own experience, in who you are within within even this community here, think about how, you know, your appearance is very different from others, your intellect is different, your interest and your direction in life is different, your age and your propensities towards things are different, your strength, your occupations are different. No, we're all amazingly, fascinatingly different. Yeah. So what are they talking about, this developing a sense of equalizing all of us? Now, I think it would be really boring if everyone looked like me. So, you know, so then what are we looking at then when we're talking about equalizing self?
Mm-hmm. Maybe not having attachments to the appearance of difference.
Why not attached to the appearance of difference? Can you explain that a little more?
When you're describing the difference, many differences between people with age and appearance and interests and strengths and occupations. But also keep in mind that it's an appearance, there's an innate difference between the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the attachment to that difference of being finite might be a source of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's nice. Uh-huh, Manila.
So essentially what we're trying to get is that we want to be equal. And how can we be equal with all these different things that are different? But the thing that makes us equal is everybody wants to be happy, and nobody wants to suffer. And that makes us equal. Because these other things are very, very different.
Mm, very good. Yeah. What makes us equal is that we all are desiring happiness, and we all don't want suffering.
And that we're all interdependent.
And that we're all interdependent. Okay. How does that make us equal?
That I, for my own existence, I rely on the person that made these clothes, and the person that paved the road that I drove here on,
mm-hmm.
the person mm-hmm. that crafted the carpet that I'm sitting on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all the sangha here, mm-hmm. the people that are moving in a similar spiritual direction.
Uh-huh. So that's beauty and diversity, but also our interconnectedness. And this is the realization of our interrelatedness and our interconnectedness helps us to develop a sense of understanding and having a wish of care and interest in others. Yeah? It helps us push beyond this me-centered mentality. Yeah. So that is a big part of looking at how do we equalize self. But then there's, you know, my community of friends, and then there are the people who I consider my foes, and then people I consider the huge gamut of strangers. So how are we going to work with that if we're all, how are we going to see them as equal?
Mm-hmm. Through our actions.
Through our actions.
How we relate to them by choice. I mean, having the perception of them being different, but choosing to treat them in a cherished way.
Treat them in a cherished way. But what about treating them in a cherished way when you have such aversion towards somebody?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Here, take this popsicle, right? Uh-huh.
It's also about not being attached as much to people, to friends, people we love,
mm-hmm.
and kind of equalize, you know, with our enemies who have less attachment.
Mm-hmm.
To cherish
mm-hmm.
that there is more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really seeing all of these different people in an equal way, and in that they too, whether it's our foes or strangers, they too want happiness and don't want suffering. Yeah? But also remember that our friends, foes, and strangers are not a permanent, independent, everlasting group either, right? You know, persons that you've had difficulties with turn out to be friends later on, you know? It's like there's like some things stuck there, and then by just your openness or some circumstance, it dissipates. And you get to know who they are, and then suddenly they're very interesting. You know, you become friends. Or someone that you really enjoy a lot, then suddenly really has some kind of upset with you because, you know, you're wearing polka dots or something. and you watch, you know, that sense of friendship then dissipates. You know, how dare you go out with me and wear polka dots? Or whatever, and you watch this sense of aversion rather than endearing attraction and interest arise. For sometimes for as silly a reason as that.
Then you remember your mother wore polka dots.
Then you remember your mother wore polka dots. Exactly, it goes like that. You know, and that's how mercurial our mind is. Our mind is constantly shifting and changing. It's like, and then you're not present anymore. You know, your friend walks up, oh, they're wearing polka dots, that's upsetting. But then you go, oh, Mom used to wear that polka dot dress, and oh yeah, and then I would ride my radio flyer down to go pick up my candy bar at the neighborhood store, and I'd run into Joe or something, you know, and it's like you're totally gone and in another dimension, you know. So to watch how this mind is constantly diffuse and going off in different things, and then you come back again and go, oh right, here's my friend in a polka dot shirt or something. And you realize and watch how that through the senses, again, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental object, you know, it just triggers interesting events from the past as well. And then you're not present, and it's like if it triggers like positive memories or positive circumstances, then you know it's like you're wanting more of it. And it's this interesting part about attraction and aversion. You know, it's like if it's attractive and pleasing and interesting to you, then you gravitate towards it. You want to entertain it a little more. You want to watch it a little more, you know, and be a little closer to it. And then if it triggers some kind of negative response in you, some sense of aversion, then you watch how you act, right? You want to cut it off. You want to hang up. You want to leave. You want to separate from it. You want to strike out at it if you can't separate from it. So all of this practice is about looking at how we develop a sense of equanimity and equal love for all sentient beings, but the way we are triggers this whole spectrum of emotion and attachment and interest and aversion. And so it's like, how do we keep, in spite of all of that that goes on, how do we develop a sense of real care and interest and appropriate behavior in our relationship with others? You know? Okay, so so another way of looking at this equanimity, a sense of equalizing with others and ourselves, is recalling that no matter who we are, we all have ups and downs, we all have good days and bad days, that we are all impermanent and face inevitable death. Think about how, you know, how our actions really have an effect on others, and that if we scream and yell and have a big upset with them, and then they turn around and yell at others or get into an accident, you know, what kind of compounded effect that has in our world, and what kind of environment are we creating, especially, you know, if it's me-centered versus really care and attention to all others. That all of us experience loss and gain, pleasure and pain, lessons of attachment and aversion, again, as in this equality, that there is no certainty in our lives, there are no guarantees that things are going to turn out and be the way we wanted it to. And all that we accumulated is going to be left behind. So think about that when you relate to others, especially, you know, in this idea of this equality. How do you establish equanimity? You know, if someone has so much more than you have, has all the circumstances and all the toys, has an excellent home, the perfect relationships, you know, wealth and beauty and longevity and good health, how do you relate to them? Especially if they're arrogant and prideful about it. How do you develop a sense of equanimity?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
Be happy for them.
Be happy for them. Yeah. Sure, you know, it's like rejoicing in their good karma to have these things. Again, thinking of your view of interdependence and interrelatedness with all others, they created conditions to have that those circumstances. You know, but instead we get jealous. We become envious and spiteful. And you think about these conditions of life, that we're all going to lose it, we're all going to get sick and die. You know? That rather than rejoicing in their good fortune, we become competitive and spiteful. Yeah, so to look at what's berserk is our mental attitude towards all of these things, you know, and that's where the adjustment needs to occur. It's within our own practice, our mental attitude, and that's why we study these things and contemplate them. Okay, so just like that, when you're working with someone, it's a coworker, and they get all the praise and the raise and the acknowledgement for things, when you might have been the backup person for all of it, creating a good team, but your coworker gets all the praise and acknowledgement. How do you work with that? How do we develop equanimity?
One of the things that this really talks about, we have to remember, we're not only in this lifetime, many lifetimes we have, and the person that has accomplished this may have done before life that deserves this, and also that we may be the ones that didn't do anything. It would be nice to do it this lifetime, so then we can get it this lifetime or this lifetime. Not to think only of this moment, but there is a past, and there is a present, and there's going to be a future. And everything's rather impermanent,
mm-hmm.
in ourselves. So we don't make it so permanent and so independent, and that it's not going to change. If we change our mental attitude, then we may just be that we will be indifferent.
Yeah, think about someone who's considered in your eyes beneath you, or lower than you in status, or economic level, or physical ability, or beauty, or whatever. I mean, we compare everything, don't we? As Americans, particularly. So when we consider or perceive someone to be less than us for whatever reason, you know, watch the way we act. Again, that's the key thing, is watch the way you act to someone that you are perceiving as less than. No, it was interesting for me that when I was in India and I was talking with an Indian family, and they, you know, it's like in the Indian Hindu view, you're born into the caste system. So you're born as a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, I forget all the levels, and then the Shudra. And then the untouchables, the outcasts, are not even in the caste. They're outcasts, right? You're not even born in the caste. But the shocking thing to me was that he said that even when you die and you're reborn, you're born into that. That you can't get out of it even by dying and getting reborn, you know. At least, for, I forget, he said something like 7 or 11 lifetimes. And I'm thinking, well, where do you start counting, you know? But, you know, this kind of solid view, and what's the purpose of that? You know, is it to solidify rank? Or is it really, you know, I mean, that could be on the negative side, but then on a more positive side, you could say and look at how we tend to perpetuate and do the things that we always do. You know, there isn't that much change. You know, when you think about where, like His Holiness says, you know, it's like when you think about where we're going to go next lifetime or what we're going to be, it's like pretty much what we're doing now. And so that gets scary to me. You know, to think that it's just going to be status quo next time around. I better get moving on my practice, you know. So to think about that as far as equalizing ourselves and others. So let's just sit for a few moments on that, and then we'll continue. So we'll sit for about 3 minutes, okay? Just contemplate equanimity in this whole range. In particular, observe your own actions. When you perceive someone as higher than you or lower than you, how do you act? And even someone you consider an equal, how do you act? How can you transform that from self-centeredness and self-cherishing to interest and care? So the second point in this analysis, the first one is equalizing self and others. The second point is reflecting on the demerits of the self-cherishing attitude. Okay, self-cherishing attitude. Self-cherishing attitude equals attachment to self, and I want to just go over some of the points, and these are translated from Venerable Gen Lobsang Gyatso. So the self-cherishing attitude is a mental attitude to avoid short-term difficulty, to avoid short-term difficulty and an unwillingness to work. Self-cherishing attitude, okay. And it's also an overindulgence of grasping onto the self and therefore being unable to endure even the slightest harm. It's such an expose, isn't it? Say it again. It's an overindulgence of grasping onto the self and therefore being unable to endure even the slightest harm. Others are so irritating if they're not taking care of or paying attention to me. You know, you watch how that little gnawing sense of irritation comes up when that mental attitude arises. Okay, so another one is this self-cherishing attitude views even minimal hardship as upsetting. Even minimal hardship as upsetting. And it includes a sense of imminent personal loss. Paranoia, also known as paranoia, yeah, right. Oh my gosh, that could just waste my time a little bit. Yeah? It's all focused on me. If it's all focused on me, you know, it's like everything's going to be, how can this interaction be beneficial to me? And it's so introverted in a way that it's hard to comprehend how to be with others, really, or how to engage and enjoy or appreciate anyone else, because it's so inward focused. Now, and so it just goes right up to this, you know, if it's so inward focused on pleasure for your own self, it's going to end up resulting in suffering. And you know what it's like when in overt situations, when people are so self-centered, you know, how much do you want to be around them? Yeah, and then also in yourselves, when it's running in yourself, you know, what kind of happiness is there inside? Not very much. Okay, so it's all a facade. It's all a ruse towards your own well-being, but in fact, it's, you know, a source of your own loss and eventual failure, and it causes us to do incongruent things towards accomplishing the goal of happiness. We keep trying for, you know, our own happiness, but we're doing these obnoxious things and hurting others as we try to accomplish our own happiness. Yeah. So, and then think about the ripening effects of this. Yeah. Since they're similar to the cause, since actions and the results of actions are similar to the cause, you know, it'll be undesirable. Okay. So, let's see. In that case, when we're having this sense of self-cherishing, yeah, and it's all in there, in it for me, you're in it for yourself. Think about how, when things aren't working your way, yeah, how we blow up and we get really upset because it's not going my way. That we totally throw out our practice, our ethics, our promises, our vows, our standards. No, I know doctors have the Hippocratic Oath? Right, doctors have the Hippocratic. Hippocratic Oath, yeah. I'm sorry.
From Hippocrates.
Hippocrates, yes, right. And that in other professions as well, you know, you have an oath in many ways to serve others and to live up to the station that you've been given, you've been empowered to do by your training. And generally, you know, you think about that, generally we're really good people. But you watch when something like our self-centered or self-cherishing attitude arises, or our strong attachment and aversion arises, that's where we get into trouble. And we throw all of those promises out the window, and we engage in heinous activity. Yeah? We lie to our bosses, our families, our employees, our children, our parents. We steal from others. We commit sexual misconduct. We go against the vows and promises of persons that we loved. We hurt and harm others. And then we engage in all kinds of cover-up to cover up the acts, partly because we want to perpetuate it, especially if it continues to be pleasurable. We cover it up, and hopefully nobody's going to see us or find us out, because our desire and our aversion is so strong that we don't care, and we just throw out all of our ethical standards. Yeah. And then it's more of a ruse. It's more of a then it becomes hypocrisy, right? It becomes the opposite of that vow and that oath. It becomes something that we live in more unclarity, more cover up, and then especially with something like lies. Like, you have to try to remember, okay, what did I tell Sharon, and what did I tell Mamie, and did I tell them the same thing? And if I didn't, I hope they don't talk to each other, because that's going to be a mix-up of what I told them, you know. And so you watch how then your all of your attention and energy goes into that cover-up and keeping up the appearance of everything's fine and clear, but in fact we engage in a you know, it keeps the mind from developing a sense of greater openness and receptivity and care and love and interest in others, doesn't it? Okay, so think about that of the problems of the demerits of self-cherishing what we engage in. Okay, so anyone want to add to that from personal experience, perhaps? Yeah, it backfires. Charlie.
I was just thinking of a broader thing. It just seems that I'm thinking of my local council person, my district person here in Long Beach, who a year and a half ago came right to our door and said, I'm going to take care of you and make sure the litter gets picked up and curbs and parking improves, and I'm for the people. And now she's taking tens of thousands of dollars from Home Depot to build on the wetlands over. It's the money and the power, you know, it's so alluring, it seems, that,
mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And all those wonderful promises that she made, and that
right.
She really seems to care about. Well, it doesn't really matter, what's important is the money.
It's really something to look at, what changes in our own life. You know, when we have these particular standards, and then we experience fame or power or money or loss of it. You know, what happens to us, and how do we act when we lose it all as well? So again, you know, in this effort to try to develop a sense of remembering that, you know, if we're wanting happiness, if in our refuge vow we're saying, you know, may I attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, that we have to really watch, you know, look at our conduct in times of fame and power, and look at our conduct when we've been defamed. You know, how do we act when someone has falsely accused us of something? You know, so to really watch, you know, how do you carry through and maintain this sense of equanimity and interest and love for others in spite of what goes on in your life? And how do we keep clearing out all this stuff, you know, all this baggage that we carry on, so that we can really instead accumulate the virtuous qualities of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? You know? So it becomes a very, very personal practice, you know, looking at not only the lofty side of practicing the Dharma and how well we can sit in meditation, but, you know, how are we conducting ourselves in the ebbs and flows of our life? Yeah, when we're diagnosed with cancer, or we're diagnosed with 6 months to live, or any of these things, you know, which will happen. So to shift from the sense of it's a me world, you know, it's like, say our spouse or our work partner gets struck down by something, then to see, you know, how do we sustain this sense of care and equanimity in spite of it. Okay, so let's switch over to reflecting on the benefits of cherishing others. Okay, so that's the third point, reflecting on the benefits of cherishing others. Someone new, would you like to comment on what benefits there might be from cherishing others? More harmony in the environment, yeah. So when you think about when we cherish others, then there's more interaction and participation, some interest in what they're doing, how to benefit them, rather than have it all be, you know, what can you do for me?
Allows us to really understand the value in our existence. You know, the depth of the value.
The value in our existence, rather than it being just disposable. That seems really loaded. Can you give more examples on that?
I think going back to the, you know, the centeredness, you know, self-centeredness, it's just us, but when we try to value someone else more, we see that there's a lot of value in everything, you know, just being alive and interacting and being here.
Uh-huh.
So, instead of just writing something off. You
know. Right. Yes. That's very nice. Yeah. Seeing value in every interaction and every person that you encounter, I think, you know, rather than plowing through others because it's, you know, it's all about me. So, yeah, very good. Another point is to think about in times of hardship when you have cared and helped others. You know, people will spontaneously and automatically want to care for you as well. You know, it's reciprocal. Our actions become reciprocal in how we interact with others. And if we've continually ignored and used others, then in our own times of need, how much receptivity do you think there would be in them wanting to help you if you've been ripping them off for years and years? So that's one thing to consider. And also this whole idea of cherishing others and looking at others, there's this story that His Holiness wrote about in one of his books, and he talks about how he had, I think he was in Bodh Gaya, and he had some incredible pain in his body, and they wanted to take him to a hospital. And the pain was so intense, but they put him in the back seat of a car, and they were driving to the hospital. But if you've ever been in Bihar state in India, it is the poorest state in India, and it's filled with remarkable potholes and creative ways of of transport as well, you know, and there are obstacles in every few feet of the way because of, you know, sacred cows walking across, there are people carrying with ox carts or pulling their own carts and things, beggars everywhere, and these amazing potholes. So the Dalai Lama was in the back of this car, and they're trying to go as fast as they can through this to get to the hospital, and every single bump in the road was causing more pain to him, So he said it was very troublesome, you know, in that ride. But then he said in his pain he managed to look out the window, and he saw this old beggar with a child, and the child was crippled, and they were incredibly emaciated in the dust. This child was crippled and sick, and here he is, you know, trying to cross the road with this sickly child. And His Holiness said the sense of compassion and interest and care for this old man and this little boy came up that was so heartfelt, you know. And if you're practicing this sense of interest and care for others, then it comes, it arises, you know. And it arose in this he said the focus went straight to them, and it took away his own pain for a few moments. It's like he didn't have that any sense of that pain because he was so concerned about these other people. And you look at how that happens when your interest is really paying attention to others. What happens, you know, to your own heart? You know, your own heart becomes so much bigger, so much more generous, and so much more brave, and able to do more. So, you know, the Dalai Lama then says, so therefore, it's important to be wisely selfish, right? He says, be wisely selfish. And in this way, when you care for others, it's going to benefit you. Yeah, it ends up benefiting you, and your own condition is benefited as well when you care for others. So, you know, think about that, how as you develop muscle in cherishing others, it becomes something that is strengthened, you know, because you realize that sometimes we have this knee-jerk reaction, right? A knee-jerk reaction to people that we have aversion to, or toward people we're attracted to. And again, when you're attracted to someone, or when you have aversion towards someone, look at how you act. Your body language, your comments, your tone of voice. Yeah, when you are full of aversion or attraction. Yeah, so as you develop muscle in your practice of cherishing others rather than looking at them as a source of your pleasure or your aversion, you know, you develop a more equanimity and care, and something that's a little more lofty than just self-interest. Okay? Mm-hmm. Parcha.
This is just an observation. When you examine our, I don't know if this is for applying to everyone, but sometimes it applies to me, that when I examine the quality of happiness that derives from serving myself, it has somewhat of an addictive quality. There's never enough.
Yeah. Never enough, and it's also benighted. It's also like you've got, you know, the blinders on. Because we keep trying to look for something for ourselves, you know, but it's very limiting. And everything else becomes irritating. Okay, so there are huge advantages to cherishing others, yeah? And so this is a very Buddhist argument for developing compassion and altruism. Okay, so then we go to the actual way to meditate on equalizing and exchanging self for others. And then there's another comment by Shantideva. And this is not from the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, but it's from the Compendium of Training. Shantideva wrote several books. And this one says, okay, so we're looking at how to actually practice this, right? But Shantideva says, acquaintance with the equality of self and other will make the mind of enlightenment stable. Self and other are dependent upon one another, and thus are false, like here and there. One side is not there in itself, in reference to another perspective. It will be here. And as self is not that, in its own right, with reference to something else, it is other. Okay, so here we are in Long Beach, and we say this is here. And then we think about Malibu, and we say Malibu is there. But if we were all having our class in Malibu, we would say this is here. And Long Beach is there, isn't it? So this whole sense of I'm speaking from here, this is me, this is self, and you are other. But from Jackie's stance, Jackie is here, is self, and I am other. Okay, so you're really looking at how it's so much of a perspective, it's just a perspective, a moving target of how we continually shift and change this view. So if we shift from rather than this self-centered view and look at more other-centered, you know, there's more other than self. And that also if we can see, you know, that all those others are also seeing self, we begin to develop more view of this interrelatedness, you know, so that whether self is in the center or on the perimeter, it's all part of the greater harmony of our interrelatedness. So every point matters, every direction matters, here and there matter, self and other matter, you know. So it all is interrelated and interdependent, because our actions then have an effect on others. Okay, so I think we need to continually familiarize ourselves with how we are interdependent. Okay, so. Also remember, you know, it's like as we strive for this happiness for ourselves, think again about how who we consider friends and people that are going to benefit us are not inherently friends, right? That it's constantly changing as well. Friends, strangers, enemies, cooperation, not cooperation. How do people view you when you're just self-centered? Do they see you as a friend? Okay, so let's, we just have a few minutes, so let me just read a few verses from the Lama Chopa, or it's called the Guru Puja, offerings to the Guru. Having considered how all these pitiful beings have been our mothers and have raised us in kindness again and again, we seek your blessings to develop unaffected compassion like that of a loving mother for the precious child. There is no difference between ourselves and others. None of us wishes even the slightest of sufferings, nor is ever content with the happiness we have. Realizing this, we seek your blessings that we may enhance the bliss and joy of others. This chronic disease of cherishing ourselves is the cause giving rise to our unsought suffering. Perceiving this, we seek your blessings to blame, begrudge, and destroy the monstrous demon of selfishness. The mind that cherishes all mother beings and would secure them in bliss is the gateway leading to infinite virtue. Seeing this, we seek your blessings to cherish these beings more than our lives, even should they rise up as our enemies. In brief, infantile beings labor only for their own end, while Buddhas work solely for the welfare of others. With a mind understanding the distinctions between the failings of one and the advantages of the other, we seek your blessings to enable us to equalize and exchange ourselves for others. Okay, so let's just sit for about 3 minutes on that. Just as a reminder, before we do the dedication of merits, Kungo Pema Chenjur will give a talk on December 9th. It's a Sunday, so it'll be after class at 1:30 p.m. So you might want to plan to do your Christmas shopping before and after. So Geshe-la will teach that morning, and then he usually ends about 12. And at 1:30, Pema Chunjur will give a talk, and he was a colon for the Tibetan government, the parliament, in exile. He taught Tibetan language at the Chandigarh University in the Punjab state and he taught Tibetan there for over 20 years. And so he worked with the Tibetan government in the security department and with the parliament for many years. So he lives here in Long Beach with his family now, and it's an opportunity for us to know a little bit more about the Tibetan community that are here. And we'll occasionally have different speakers and events. So that's December 9th at 1:30 p.m. And also, as we do the dedication of merits, I'd like to remember Mamie's friend, Jane Ju. Junju, who has cancer, and also Chodak. He was a monk, one of the first Western monks in the Tibetan tradition, and he later disrobed and had a family, but he and he is a very good teacher, but he had a head trauma, and he's in the hospital in San Francisco. He's been there for a couple weeks. And also, let's add our prayers for all those who lost their homes in the fires, and those that have been affected by these tragedies, not only here but everywhere. Okay, and we'll wish for the long life and happiness, removal of suffering of all sentient beings everywhere. Okay. Because of these merits, may we quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. By the virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas visualized before me, this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and the moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniya Tayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Shinrezi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. I'd also like to add one more announcement, and that today is Venerable Tartso's fifth anniversary of becoming a monastic. So congratulations. It's better than samsaric birth into, you know, we celebrate our birthdays, but this is birth into taking up the path. It's very, very much cause for celebration. Okay, so we'll do our bows. Thank you.